Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Elveson, and this is the Digital Education Podcast. So just officially went on iTunes and got it approved, so this is cool for me, and it's exciting for me to continue to have these conversations with new friends, but innovators, leaders in education. Today, I'm with Daniel Pampuk, who is the CEO of Christian Schools Australia, where he oversees 140 Christian schools and provides advocacy for additional 40 schools across Australia, representing 60,000 students. He's also an expert in next generation leadership and wrote his PhD on that. And that's why I'm talking to Daniel today. Daniel, next generation leadership. When you did your research, you focused in on millennials. Why is that next generation not choosing education number one and not choosing leadership number two?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think education, it requires many countries to have the same qualifications as a whole range of other pursuits, whether that be in accounting, law. So the amount of commitment that's required to study is the same. I think the pressures and the regard for education for many people looking at their future career choice is not highly regarded as some of those other professions. So we're competing against other professions which have a high level of support, high level of remuneration, and education is seen as one of the things which is really quite tough, dealing with most of the difficulties and pressures of society, and schools are seen as a solution to those problems. So it's seen as a very tough vocation to get into. In terms of aspiration, I think that when the thing that turns most young people off leadership is the current view or vantage point that they have of the leader who is currently in the role. First thing is that they would probably see that there's a very poor work-life balance that exists that's there. They would see that the leader is the one who carries the can or takes responsibility for things that often aren't of their doing or making, but they're still responsible for. That there's a lot of competing pressures upon their time. And they also don't see, when they look at the leader of a school, they don't see themselves. They see, often it's an older male. And so for the age, the gender, even the ethnicity can say to them, this is what a leader looks like. This is what they've always looked like. And so because they don't look like me, that means that's not a role for me to do either.
So as I was reading your blog and even just hearing you talk about that a little bit, is sometimes we misalign or malign millennials, this next generation, as being weak, not very tough. You know, they get parodied a lot. But when you explain it that way, they've just got a better perspective on life. Doesn't it seem that way?
Yeah, and it is true. And look, and let's not confuse also that when we look at millennials, we're talking about age and stage. And so we're comparing young people with mature, well-established professionals who've been in a career a long time. And so there's some unfair comparisons that if we looked at all of those leaders when they were in their 20s or in their early 30s, they were struggling with issues and, you know, trying to establish themselves in their own context. So there's a difference between saying there's a difference when we talk about cohorts such as boomers or Gen X or millennials, to say there are things that they grew up with which shaped who they are. But then there's a difference to saying, well, this is what the issues faced by a 20-year-old who's entering into the workforce as opposed to a 30-year-old who's maybe getting married and wanting to have buy a house, to somebody who's having children and is, you know, wanting to establish a family. So we have different age and stage things. So sometimes millennials are criticised or emerging leaders are criticised because of the stage of life they're in, rather than the fact that it actually describes their differences as a cohort.
So then how do we foster within that next generation, how do we foster an interest maybe in education, but more so those who are in education, how do we foster and how do we change this perspective of leadership that would draw them into and prepare them for leadership and maybe even a new way of doing leadership?
Look, I think one of the misconceptions about millennials, and you said this, is that they don't, some people will say the millennials don't want to work as hard. No, it's not true. Or they just, if they do, they all want a promotion, they want the corner office and these kind of perceptions. But when I've surveyed and met with and discussed with millennials around aspiring. It's actually about opportunities, and that doesn't mean a step up. It could be a step out or across. And they're wanting a diversity of experiences, which says, and not only this is not a one-off, and often when they're given experiences, it's by a leader who says, look, I've got a need. Can you fill that need for me? And then you can have that opportunity. When millennials actually want somebody to speak into their world and to say, we have a plan for you. We want to train you. We want to give you professional development. So we're going to give you a range of opportunities. And yes, that may meet a school's need, but it's not a Machiavellian in terms of the only time you get an opportunity is when we want something from you. So that's the first one. The second one is to try and break, but just to be aware of who actually occupies the leadership positions within a school. And very often it is a very similar gender profile, age profile, ethnicity and cultural profile that we have in those positions as well. And so for millennials who are coming up, and particularly I would say for young females, being told that there is a possibility that's there, that and modelling that in terms of what that looks like within school is really important, because if I don't see myself, I don't think I belong. And so there's a good way of opening that up. Probably the other one that's different is the style of leadership for a millennial to somebody who may be a little bit older. So as we are changing between the age demographics, the millennial is more likely to work in a group and is more likely to collaborate, is more likely to call upon the skills and experiences of others. And sometimes there's a mentality that came from the 1900s, which was what we used to call as the hero or the Superman or the great man theory, which was to be a leader, you had to be an expert in all different areas. And we still do this today. And we have all these blogs around, you know, past CEO of GE and, you know, Steve Jobs and, you know, all of these ones to say, weren't they just superhuman in what they're able to achieve? It's unfair on them. It's unfair on our current leaders. And it really does turn off our aspiring leaders. And so what we need to be able to say to them is that the model of when we appoint leaders in the future is that we are a team. Yes, there is somebody who will take, who will be the captain of that team, but really we want to play to the skill sets of all of those people. We're going to have a diversity of our leadership with a range of skills. We'll try and flex and develop each person's skill set, but we're not going to do this alone because we know that society is too complex, the world that we're living in is too complex, the needs upon schools are too complex. And when you know that you're doing that with other people, and particularly for the millennials or the Gen Ys coming through, that's something that's a lot more attractive to them in terms of aspiring to leadership.
So you know, and you talk about it, and then in your leadership now in the short time of you know, the Australian schools is, like, are you programmatically going about, like, recruitment of leadership, or are you working with schools on just even the redesign of what they think of their organizational chart and leadership practices that would generate more opportunity to be part of the work with each other that might attract this next generation?
Yeah, and look, I think the first part that starts, we always want to look at the principal administrator or CEO and say, well, aren't they doing a fabulous job? And again, we fall back into that great man theory of approach. And it starts with boards, and it starts with those associations and committees that are at the top, because they're the easiest place to bring in a set of skilled people who are there and to diversify how we're seeing things. I think it's also modelling in terms of schools of best practice to say, here's a school that has actually diversified its leadership. So for me, I was a school principal before taking on this role, and we had a school of 1,600 and I formed a cabinet of leaders. And across that, we had a range of skill sets, and the staff would see very clearly that you know, this wasn't just me leading from the front, but there were a whole range of skilled people. We also rotated positions. So where we had middle management positions within the schools, it wasn't a for life position. So we rotated those quite regularly to say, we want to give a range of people a range of opportunities to do these roles. And we had the other currency you have in a school is not just title or finances, but it's also time. And so in terms of giving people time to pursue things, whether that's study or training. And so we are committed in our institution to providing 50% of the costs training up our next generation of leaders so they could do masters of higher education degrees in an area that they felt was going to contribute. So you could do things that weren't, just give them a role, but it's an opportunity, it's investing into them. I'm getting them to lead and take advantage of some of those opportunities. One of the ones in particular I'm still working with is an emerging leader, Jen. And Jennifer has started a women in leadership group, which she does as a network, which she started and is still doing to this day. And I think she has about 150 women who are her age who get together to encourage and inspire and to see each other go forward. And so then it's then about rolling that out amongst other schools. It's very hard to tell a school to change because it's a cultural thing. You know, if it's not just a financial, but to let them see best practice and say it is possible. These are the types of things that you can be doing. I think it flows, to other practitioners to adopt as well.
So, Daniel, let me ask, maybe one last question, and it is very broad, so you can take it in any way you want, because I think it is multidimensional in a sense. And you've written about the baby boomers that, are still kind of hanging on, and yes. They're working, they're living longer, they're working, the opportunities to work longer are there. And so some of the leadership capacity seems to be closed, or some of the leadership opportunities seem to be closed out. But when they retire en masse, we have, kind of this mass retirement, and then you have the millennials who aren't in education and aren't in education leadership as much. Like, at what time does maybe shortage or education shortage become a crisis? And then at what point in time, and have you started thinking about like the next generation, this Generation Z that everyone's talking about, and what, where they might fit and how you might kind of prepare for a future, with that next generation coming through? I mean, it's kind of a broad question and multidimensional, and you've talked about, some of these different pieces and written about them, but I mean, that's maybe just something I was thinking about, projecting outwards how this all looks in 10 years.
Yeah, look, and I think to start with, I would say, who knows how long some of those baby boomers will hold on to. So, and I think the thing there is that they do have something to offer. So I'm not ageist in terms of saying one cohort is better than another one and that, look, let's remove all the baby boomers. Don't get me wrong. I do think there's a place for our baby boomers, but I think we need to be saying, well, what does that transition look like for them? So that's the starting point. And we need to have other roles for them to step into that's just not, well, thank you for your time and your service, we're now pushing you to the side. For some, still have a longevity in terms of what they're doing and may serve for a few more years, which is great. Others, we may want to transition onto some boards. We may want to transition them into mentoring and coaching. We may want to transition them into writing and establishing. And for us, one of the big issues we had is that a lot of the baby boomers were the pioneers. And so they did it because they had a passion. They were very mission focused. But a lot of the things that they do are implicit. And they did it, and it's a cultural and it's part of the communities they formed. But then actually capturing that and making it explicit so that another generation can understand that is a really important process. So I'd say that about the boomers to begin with. They're almost having to, like Moses did, write the book of Deuteronomy for a new generation who are going to take on to the promises of God. So I want to really say that the boomers have a space and a role to play. The next generation is Gen X, and this is almost like the hot potato generation, I would say, because they will be given leadership for a very short period of time before they're required to pass that on. And so they will not be a long-term leadership group as the baby boomers were. They're a smaller group. But I do think that they are have one unique element, which is really good. They're not institutionalized. They're not passionate about the institution. They're passionate about the people. So being the latchkey kids, they see that institutions have the potential to damage relationships, to take parents away from their children, to be more focused on form and structure than they are about the mission and the intent. So the Gen X play a great role in saying, well, how do we go back to the spot that we need to be? And I think are quite happy to encourage and inspire the Gen Ys to come up. So I'm less panicky about a leadership crisis because of those two elements that are there. And I think it'll be a dawning. So once we bring in the Gen Ys, I think the Gen Ys are passionate. We may see, though, that we have to get rid of some of their misconceptions around in schools that exist. We're very traditional institutions. We're very conservative. Add on, if you've got a faith institution, just kind of multiplies in terms of that conservative nature. We like things to be very structured in institutions like schools. So the thought that somebody progresses through and does what I would call an apprenticeship, where you spend 10, 20 years learning the ropes, rising through the ranks, that's something that may have to go, where we bring people who are traditionally have come from what I call a stable, that look like, sound like, have a background, a pedigree that we're happy with. And so that will need to be broken with Gen Y, because Gen Y will come with a suite of skills and experiences. And we need to value those range of skills and opportunities that are out there, rather than saying that there's somehow credit given for a number of years doing the same thing. So it'll be a perception change that will need to occur with boards and with leaders in terms of valuing something that they haven't traditionally done. And that for me is exciting, because what will happen then is that it'll put a pressure back on boards and senior leaders to say they will need structure and help in terms of understanding how to bring and maximise that input. But the opportunity to step out of what we've traditionally done and find new ways of engaging students, new ways of educating, new ways of gathering data and research, improving our practice, collaborating, taking hold of 21st century technologies and ideas, is really sitting with the Gen Y. And we now need to allow a room for them to expand and change the paradigm, but provide enough structure and support that they don't fall over, that they don't overstretch in terms of their capabilities that are there. And from that vantage point, I think I'm very excited about Gen Z. I think they'll have the best. If we can do well for those current generations that are there and see that there are differences, we'll be well established to be looking to see what the unique differences are for Gen Z coming through and be able to support them better.
So that's exciting to hear. And I appreciate your comments about baby boomers, because I think there is, you know, a way forward that, you know, for them, you know, as they think about their legacy and their impact. Yeah. And your just phrase of being the pioneers, I had never even heard that or even thought of that before.
Mm. And we've got to honor and respect them, because I think, how we treat them is how we will be treated by the following generation. And that's what I want to say, is that they've got a lot to offer and a lot to contribute. And what we need to be encouraging them to do as well is, rather than holding on, and you can, you know, holding on almost to the point of getting white knuckles, is to encourage them to start stepping into a role of statesperson, a statesman and stateswomen, who through the life and the transformation of who they've become, really becomes a model for those who are below them, because they'll be needed. That wisdom is something that you cannot purchase, you cannot read. It's gained through experience, through difficulties, through struggles, through falling on your face. And there is something incredibly important about what they have to offer. We just have to shape those opportunities, which respects and honours them, but also allows that to be mobilised so that another generation gets the benefit of that.
So maybe one final question to wrap up,
sure.
You know, because this is great stuff and I love it. I've been thinking a little bit about this as you talk about generational leadership, and you look at schools, you look at boards, and I just did a survey this past year in the United States of open heads of schools positions, and only about 10% of them hired someone internally. And oftentimes, I think it was 40% of the hires had been a head of school someplace else. So it's kind of the shifting of the deck. How do you encourage boards who fairly are disconnected, possibly with, you know, what's going on in the marketplace? How do you encourage boards to really think about this and go deeper for an idea of generational leadership that would create a dynamic nature and a duplicative nature to the capacity of their institution?
Yeah. Look, I think the first issue that's there is that there's a very large gap between the superintendent or principal's role or head's role to the next position down. And that it's a structural issue within a school environment that we do see, what that role is in a school, is quite a distance. And so in terms of confidentiality of information, strategic planning, discussions with boards, et cetera, to get somebody who can readily step into that role becomes quite challenging. And so the fact that you say it's at 10% doesn't surprise me. But in saying that, doesn't, you know, relinquishes a board's responsibility or a leader's responsibility to be training up a range of people below them. And so the question then says, it should be, you know, what are the experiences or what are the opportunities we should be giving to our second tier within that school environment so that they are ready to step up, whether that's in their own context or another context. One of the staff that I employed said to me the reason why they missed out on you know, a principal's position was the fact that they'd never presented to a board, and so another candidate got that role. So there are a range of things. So whether it's, you know, doing business plans, whether it's strategic planning, reporting to a board, having to walk through a process with a staff member through, you know, from underperformance, enrollment interviews, marketing, all of these things. You know, the question is how we provided these opportunities, not giving them to say, well, okay, now this is yours and I'm giving away all of this responsibility and work to do, but an opportunity to say, would you like to participate and partner in that? And then in a sense, we will have a wider pool within an individual school. I think often why we're picking from other schools is that because our current leader has been there for so long, and it can be 20 plus years, that the board is often saying we need something fresh to come in for the direction of the school. And there's a question of what should be the lifespan of a principal within a school. In the 80s, we were following a very corporate model, and we were losing principals every 5 years because there was an idea out there that we should only have a five-year principal. Before that, it was much longer. And since that time, when we saw the impact that schools are not institutions or companies, they're communities, that turning over your leader too quickly, you know, injures relationship and community and that stability that we need in relationship building. So I think addressing the question of how long we should have a principal in a role for and what's a healthy time of transition will allow that to change as well. And then the other thing is that when you're employing somebody outside of an organisation, they always look a lot shinier than the person you have inside, because you know all the faults and flaws of the one you've got, and the one outside can interview very well in an interview, but it's not until you get them in the chair that you realise that they're just as competent as the one you had on board as well. And sometimes the difficulty in that is that the person who wasn't selected within the school, who can see that they had equal skill sets, can sometimes become a little bit disenfranchised. And that's what boards need to be aware of as well.
Daniel, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for joining me from Australia. And I look forward to spending time with you at the Global Christian School Leadership Summit in San Antonio in January.
Great to talk to you, Eric. It's a pleasure.